Been wanting to do that all day. Thank you again for being with us this afternoon. My name is Dr. Thomas O'Brien. I'm the director of the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center, which is one of the five Federal Highway Administration workforce centers that have been established around the country. And I will be moderating this afternoon's panel and also serving as a panelist, providing some comments for today's discussion on creating the 21st century workforce. We will be pleased to collect written questions you may have for our panelists, which is, as you saw, was very successful with the last panel. I would like to, again, thank Administrator Flowers for her excellent presentation and really engaging discussion, as well as to Karen Philbrick for moderating that as well. I learned a lot. Our panelists for this afternoon's discussion are these wonderful experts who have given us their time this afternoon. First to my left is Kristen Dekus, who is the CEO and director of the Port of Hueneme in California, in Ventura County. Ms. Dekus is a proven leader who has repeatedly demonstrated her ability to build vision and implement strategy through open, collaborative processes that foster results. The Port of Hueneme-related activities generate $1.1 billion in annual economic impact and create more than 10,200 direct, indirect, induced, and influenced jobs. Next to Kristen is Carol Kuster, who is the Director of Electronic Payments for the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and Bay Area Toll Authority. Her team manages and operates Fast Track, which is the regional toll payment system, and Clipper, the regional transit payment fare card. Together, these programs are responsible for managing well over 2 million user accounts and move nearly $75 million in transactions each month. Next, we have Jim Meisner, who is a director of technical standards at Qualcomm Technologies, leading international automotive standardization efforts. He's active in automotive and communication standards in the US, Europe, and Asia. Prior to joining Qualcomm in 2014, Mr. Meisner was an independent consultant with a variety of public sector clients that included the US Department of Transportation and private sector clients, primarily in Silicon Valley. And then last but certainly not least is Dr. Mark Novak, who was the dean of the Extended University Division at California State University, Bakersfield. And as an aside, I'm really proud of the role that the Cal State system has played in this discussion today. So Extended University offers flexible graduate, undergraduate, and professional development programs designed specifically for working adults in Bakersfield and around the world. Dr. Novak leads the university's workforce development initiatives and is instrumental in preparing students for jobs in the transportation field. So please first help me by welcoming all of our panelists. And in a minute, we're going to start the discussion by talking generally about the challenges to creating the 21st century transportation workforce from their perspectives, and then we'll get into your individual questions. Since I know we haven't been able to take all of the questions, there have been so many good ones, we did set up a little mini survey that you can access via your smartphone to provide some input into the challenges that you think are most critical, and it will allow us to engage with you over the longer term, and we hope to share the findings on both the MTI and the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center website. So if you wanted to text Summit 2016, it's S-U-M-M-I-T 2016, all one word, to area code 562-287-5175, that's 562-287-5175. We can make sure that the conversation continues beyond this room today. So thank you. I wanted to start and provide a little bit of perspective from the university setting about the challenges that we face in helping to design workforce programs that respond to the needs of industry and government, as you heard today. And I want to talk a little bit in particular about the question of the millennials. And one of the things that I think that we can do most effectively in the education sector is help better understand the labor markets that are at play in our various communities. And if millennials are the generation that will implement the new technologies in transportation, how can we best support that group? And as you heard, it's now the largest workforce in the U.S. history. And this is critical in part because this is not just a question of the future leaders. The millennials are coming into leadership positions right now, and understanding needs, interests, from a workforce perspective, we can be more responsive in designing programs. I was looking at Fortune magazine not too long ago, and Fortune was reporting on a research project that was done by Princeton-based Educational Testing Services. And they were the research was looking at developing and administering a basic skills assessment tool. And I'm going to quote from the article. "Millennials in the U.S. fall short when it comes to the skills employers want most. Literacy, including the ability to follow simple instructions, practical math, and, hold on to your hat, a category called problem solving in technology-rich environments." Now, to Councilman Baines' comment this morning about his concerns about literacy, I think this sort of this reinforces it. But what's interesting to me is that our general assumptions about that a generation raised on technology is immediately ready to use it as a skill set on the job is something that we may want to question. How do you actually tailor that experience and that familiarity and level of comfort with technology in a way that translates into effectiveness on the workplace? Similarly, in the discussion this morning with Hyperloop, I heard another assumption that I think maybe needs to be questioned, and that's the commitment of millennials to the workforce. One of the things that AP said was that the willingness to be creative, work outside of the lines a little bit, is something that makes the difference in his company. It actually allows them to create the tools that are used in the development of this system. So I think moving beyond the stereotypes is a good first step. And so that also means, back to Councilman Baines' point this morning, looking at developing the skill sets tied to not only to literacy, but digital literacy as well. And then I would add a third challenge that we're facing in terms of preparing the next generation of the workforce. And if you look at the American Community Survey, what really stands out is that millennials are increasingly likely to be foreign-born with a first language other than English. This creates tremendous opportunities, but also tremendous challenges. So to give you just a couple of facts from the ACS. 1 in 4 millennials speaks a language other than English at home. In New York, New Jersey, Texas, New Mexico, and Nevada, that proportion increases to 1 in 3. And here in California, it increases again to 1 in 2 millennials. So that's great opportunity, because if you have a second or even a third language, it makes you much more marketable on a global stage where transportation is at play. But it also may create barriers of entry to our own U.S. workforce that we need to address as well. The other thing I think that it's important from a research and labor market perspective is to understand how unique communities within the younger generation workforce identify their needs. I was reviewing a couple of recent reports. One was a study done by the Society of Women Engineers, which looked particularly at some of the gender differences that still remain in workforce, and also how different genders identify workforce and workplace priority. Particularly because many companies are finding it challenging to meet female hiring goals, and more importantly, to retain them, especially 5 to 8 years after they started, which is a critical period. And the Society of Women Engineers study found that for women in particular, accountability is the number one personal and professional value, right? And the fact that they're leaving in greater numbers than men, particularly after a five-year period, and even if they're in leadership positions, may indicate that they have less tolerance, as they should, for unfair practices that inhibit their ability to achieve excellence, right? And because millennials have also indicated in studies, the Deloitte has just come out with its fifth annual global survey of millennials, one of the things that it found is that one of the key criteria for success and commitment at the workplace is having leadership tools being developed. So understanding how we can contribute to that in the programs that we develop in the educational sector, I think, is critical. And so I'll close with a couple of comments on what some of those foundational workforce skills could be. The administrator talked about some of the soft skills that could contribute to robust educational programs in transportation. I heard a couple of things in the discussion this morning already and in the administrator's comments that suggest a good place to start. One is good communication skills. That's come up a number of times. The ability to work in culturally diverse environments is not just increasingly important, it's essential. I thought it was very interesting that the administrator mentioned conflict resolution and negotiation as being a very important and valuable skill moving forward, particularly in certain transportation sectors like transit, where you have a sometimes adversarial relationship between labor and management. I thought that was a really good point. Critical thinking, analytical skills, and also creativity are valued. And then project management, including basic budgeting skills, prove increasingly valuable as well. And how do we do that? And what does it mean? Well, it means maybe we have to go a little bit old school before you can go high tech, right? Or you have to tackle them both at the same time. And we heard some good discussions this morning about how you balance and develop technical skills with some of the critical and analytical theoretical skills by taking on programs like apprenticeships. And this is something that Dan Richard and Tim Rainey and Oliver Baines talked about this morning. And from my own perspective, most of my work in transportation has to do in the fields of logistics and supply chain management. And I can tell you that there's a renewed interest in looking at apprenticeships as a pathway to success for not only entry-level fields, but also people who are coming out of bachelor's programs with some good raw talent, but that needs to be shaped so it better understands the culture and the needs of a particular industry. And in supply chain, what a lot of the European companies do, and is just coming to our shores, is bring on people and then rotate them through all of the different divisions within a company. That way they get to understand from a much bigger picture how the industry works. And it sort of allows them to understand the culture of not only the company, but as I said, but the industry. So those are some preliminary thoughts I had on the challenges from my perspective of as an educator and a researcher. But what I'd like to do is ask the panel now to provide some of their own thoughts, and then we'll begin taking questions. So please start filling out your cards and sending them my way so we can have a discussion. But so let me turn it over to you, Kristen.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and happy Friday. Made it to the weekend here. I thought it'd be fun just to start out with a little personal history. My grandmother was born in Bergen, Norway, and her grandfather was the harbor master of Bergen, Norway, and had a son, her dad, that sailed clipper ships when she was a little girl. So when she was 8 years old, they moved to Philadelphia, and he sailed clipper ships working for United Fruit, who is Chiquita today and my biggest customer. So it's sort of a wild story, interesting coincidence, but it's not what drove me to transportation. Somehow I think my ancestry may have led me there, but it's certainly not what got me into the field. It wasn't necessarily my academics. I was an economics major from the University of Vermont, went on, got a master's in environmental policy and law from the University of Denver. So that's not really what drove me into the transportation field. It was really more opportunity, mentors, and a little luck being in the right place at the right time. And I just share that with you because I think it just shows a little bit of the disconnect and the challenge between the academia and finding ways into the field of transportation. Along the way, I've never seen a Port 101 class necessarily. And I just think that there you could have the opportunity to really build a bridge and find opportunities in the port landscape or the port career track. So with that, I just quickly, a little history on the Port of Hueneme, too, because I think it brings some context to a discussion. I just ask by a show of hands here, how many folks know where the Port of Hueneme is or have heard of it? Okay, very few of you. That's how many of you can say it. Okay, so yeah. The Port of Hueneme is about an hour north of LA and Long Beach, and because we're in the backyard of the big giant ports, we often get perceived of this very small port, but actually if you look at us through a national lens, we're about the same size as the Port of San Diego, and we rank in the top 11% of ports for non-containerized and containerized freight, so a little bit bigger than most people think. Where do we get our name? Hueneme, a little bit different. So the Chumash Indians used to walk from where Ventura is today to the port, and they would gear up there to mobilize and trade with their fellow Chumash Indians on the Channel Islands. And so the area became very, very active. And in Chumash Indian language, well, it became very active and known as the halfway point. And in Chumash Indian language, the word halfway point is Hueneme. So when the Spanish came in, actually it was Cabrillo working for the Spanish, Portuguese, came in. They couldn't quite pronunciate Hueneme because of the W in the language. So they made it their own. Think of Huevos Rancheros. They turned it into Hueneme. So that's how we got our name, dating all the way back to our Indian roots. We've always been a hub supporting trade. Well, if you flash forward into the 1800s, the first pier was built by a man by the name of Thomas Bard. And we actually exported grain from Hueneme and brought it here to San Francisco. And then we brought lumber back down to the Port of Hueneme. So that was our first trade routes. Mr. Thomas Bard had a son named Richard Bard who had a vision to build a bigger port because right outside the mouth of our port, there's a channel that goes 600 feet deep. It stretches 4 miles long. It's just a very natural place to go build a port. So they went, petitioned the federal government for funding to build a national seaport for prosperity. And Uncle Sam says, no, 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 it doesn't pencil out, not the economic justification. So years of perseverance, Richard Bard raised enough private money to build the port, then petitioned the state of California to get designation as a commercial seaport. So that's how we became a function of the state of California and have the governance structure that we have here today. And that all happened in 1937. Well, 5 short years later, we had World War II in 1942, and all of a sudden this was a very strategic hub to support the military mission. So the Navy came in and took the port over by eminent domain. So now we have Navy Base Ventura County in our port, and what's happened over times in peace is that pieces of the port real estate have come back to the commercial seaport. So now we're a collective harbor. It's just sort of an interesting history there because the Navy supports 25,000 jobs and we support 10,000 jobs. So collectively, we're a major economic engine and backbone for Ventura County. That said, what are the kinds of cargoes that we handle at the Port of Hueneme? Well, we handle a lot of automobiles. We offload what's called row-row, roll-on, roll-off cargo. We bring about 340,000 automobiles in the port a year, 650,000 tons of bananas. That's, if you line them all up, it's enough to go around the world 12 and a half times. You can't get a banana in our country, really, unless you import it. We also export a lot of our local grown produce that's in Ventura County. We handle a lot of project cargo and a lot of fertilizer. And that really does translate into all kinds of different sorts of jobs and maybe a lot of jobs that you wouldn't think of. In construction, for instance, maintaining, we have $179 million worth of infrastructure that we have to maintain. So there's all kinds of permitting jobs associated with that. We dredge our ports. It's all kinds of unique construction jobs and engineering jobs affiliated with that. There's all kinds of service-oriented jobs from lawyers to insurance to freight forwarding to accounting, marketing, environmental compliance is a huge industry of its own in today's, particularly here in California with such robust regulations. Security compliance has emerged as a huge career. It's really epic almost how many jobs have come since 9/11 in the wake of 9/11. Cyber security is another big issue. Technology is huge in our industry. Economic forecasting is very important. So these are very high-paying jobs in terms of operations. We have pilots. They make a lot of money. I don't even know if I should tell you what the guys make up here in San Francisco, but it's over $400,000 a year, I think. These are good paying jobs. Tug operators, stevedores, crane operators, processors. So there's just a number of jobs. And in fact, the port industry in the United States employs 23 million people. The average wage related with a port job is $54,000 a year. And according to the Social Security Administration, the average wage of a job is $46,000. So port jobs are 15% higher on average. So they're high-paying jobs. So certainly a lot of opportunities there. What I find when I go out and put good-paying jobs out to bid, I have trouble filling them. I had a great position for an accountant, and I got 5 applications for that position. I had an application for receptionist. I got 170 applications. So it's just sort of an interesting dynamic. You know, with business development position I put out, I got 1 qualified candidate. She's great. I hired her. But again, it kind of goes back to that disconnect of what's out there and what people are studying to come into this industry. It's just sort of interesting. So something that we're doing at the port level to help address this concern, we have a couple programs we're rolling out. One, we have a memorandum of understanding with the high school where we run a 10-week course, and it's an hour after school, 1 day a week for those 10 weeks, and we have an expert from the field come in and educate our kids, whether it's a customs official, a freight forwarder, they go tour a processing plant, they go get on a vessel, they meet the folks from Del Monte, they have a different experience every week. And then at the end of the course, we take it very seriously, these kids take a final exam, and then the 2 excelling students get a paid internship with the port. So it exposes kids to opportunities right in their backyard that they might not otherwise know about, and then they get the opportunity to get the internship, which is certainly a good resume booster, and exposes them to, again, an industry that they might not otherwise have been aware of. And some of these kids, it's been a huge win for us because of the talent. We have kids that go off, a lot of motivated kids, you know, would get invest themselves in this sort of thing. So we've had kids that are going to go off to Stanford. I'm like, no, you can't go. You got to stay at the port, you know, that kind of thing. But it's been great. And this year, right now, we have a class going on, and we have 24 students. So that's been great. The other thing we've rolled out is something called MAST, and it's a Maritime Advanced System Technology Laboratory, where we invite the community in, and the port really serves as a hub or an incubator to test new technologies. And so that's been very strategic to support our entrepreneurs in our county and give their products an opportunity to get tested in the maritime environment. But we've also opened our doors to the students to test technologies that they're developing in the classroom in the port environment. And we actually have this big tank. And I don't know if anyone saw the movie Spare Parts, but along those lines, we have robotics competitions that we're doing in this tank right at the port. So again, just a way to embrace our youth, build ladders of opportunity, and some of the things that we're doing. So I'll close there, and I'll look forward to any questions and the remark of my colleagues.
It's very exciting to hear what you're doing. Yeah. Carol.
Well, I think I need to leave now and go apply for a job at the port. I also think it's really remarkable what a small world it is actually in transportation, despite the modal differences and the geographies. Kristen, I'm struck by your little history about clipper ships. One of the programs that I deliver here in the Bay Area, and I hope those of you who live here are all clipper card holders, this is a transit smart card fare payment system that started its life known as TransLink. And when we went to rebrand the program, when it was really in a different stage of development, very exciting, there was a big naming initiative that went on, but ultimately we wanted something that represented the history of the Bay Area and speed and transportation, and so the program is now known as the Clipper Program in honor of Clipper ships. So that's a nice parallel. And I also have a father-in-law whose start in transportation was in the Berlin Transit Authority as the HR manager. So I do really actually think that some of these personal proclivities and family ties lead many of us to our transportation careers because to outsiders they otherwise sound so daunting. I work here in the San Francisco Bay Area at a bizarre-sounding organization called the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. We are a planning, funding, and coordinating and operating entity that delivers services for the 9 Bay Area counties and on behalf of our 101 cities and were creation of the state legislature. So if you're a young, technically inclined person, that might not be the first place you're going to come look for a job. And it is tricky to deliver tolling and transit technology programs in a government organization, especially here in Silicon Valley, where government is viewed as old school and inflexible and doesn't offer the kind of short-term, high-paid, stock benefit kind of packages that the tech sector does. So I do think that a big challenge for us is, like Kristen mentioned, trying to get the right people with the right skill sets to apply for our jobs and to be successful in our jobs. Our positions are very interdisciplinary. Of course, very few people go to school to be interdisciplinary, so we do end up hiring folks who are urban planners and engineers and financial experts. And each and every one of those people also needs to be able to be a solid writer and someone who can present before elected officials. Maybe not each and every one. Sometimes we'll relieve folks of those duties. But that is part of being effective inside a government agency, is being able not only to develop your program and technical ideas, but to be able to present them in a way that's compelling. And that's a tricky skill set to get in one set of people. One of the problems that I would say we are grappling with in our organization is this question of the extent to which we should be hiring skills in-house or relying on consultants and experts out-of-house. Traditionally, we've kept our organization quite lean, and we've done a lot of procurement to bring in not only the contractors who are developing our very complex tolling and transportation and transit technology systems, but there's that whole layer as well of needing to provide and have make some strategic decisions about which way to take these programs. And we use right now a mix of staff and sort of technical advisor consultants. And our commissioners are often asking the question, well, we're paying a lot of money to this consultant class. Shouldn't we maybe think about building up our own staff instead? And there's a real interplay there. There's a real mix. But one of the challenges of staffing up is certainly getting the right folks to apply at the salaries that we're able to offer and retaining those folks. And I think part of the problem as well, back to the millennials, is that one of the benefits of working in a government organization can be when you're there for the long haul, a pension, the rewards of, you know, good health care can be great in the long term, but it's not that quick win that is attracting a lot of those applicants. So we do certainly struggle with getting the right kinds of folks to fill our positions. We do a lot of on-the-job training. We're fortunate to have a high school internship program and a college internship program. Both of those have resulted in a lot of very good employees. But we do have the challenge of every time we're going out to look for folks to work for us, we have to explain who we are, what the program is that we're delivering, and why we need the skill sets that we do. So I happen to live with someone who works at Google, and I can tell you they don't have that problem. They have a lot less explaining to do. It just automatically sounds like a great place to work. I think that a lot of the folks that work in our agency, one of the things that brings us to the agency and keeps us there, though, is that sense of public service. And so when we can find tech-oriented individuals who are very interested in giving back, they tend to be the right kinds of people for us. And certainly we're not the only place. There are lots of smart city initiatives and big data initiatives that combine that desire to apply tech to civic problems. I would say the challenge I have is explaining to folks, no, come work for a metropolitan planning organization. Really, it's okay. You can work in government, and you can be part of delivering Clipper and Fast Track, which are consumer programs that touch everyone's lives and really impact and support mobility in the Bay Area. I think packaged that way, the work can be exciting, but that's a lot to communicate to a young person who's starting out in their career. And I guess maybe I'll just also add, we are increasingly in need of folks who have IT skills. And there is obviously in this region a ton of competition with other companies that need IT workers. But I think unlike some of what I was hearing from Ed Reskin at Muni this morning, where he was talking a lot more about the blue-collar workforce, maintenance jobs, and the like, that's absolutely true for transit more broadly. For the complex intelligent transportation systems programs or advanced transportation challenges that we face, I'm really going to need IT professionals and very sophisticated problem solvers who can come and help work on and deliver our programs. So I'll just leave it with that.
It's a good segue.
It is, and I just want to add before we get on to Jim, the Deloitte survey that I mentioned was really interesting because it reinforces the point you just made about while everybody who enters the workforce is interested in compensation for those 20, or I guess it was 8,000 millennials that were surveyed as part of that study, the ability to gain fulfillment through public service on the job was critical to success in the workplace. So onto something that I think that's interesting.
Yeah. The motivation.
Yeah.
But I'm here to talk a little bit. I guess I'm the designated techie for better or worse. Yeah, and I can tell you, we started with personal vignettes. I'll start with one which doesn't sound so good when it starts, but I'll tell you what I did the 16 years thereafter. So I got into transportation by doing unmanned ground vehicles. But then I worked 16 years at UC Berkeley doing transportation research. I think they counterbalance one another. But the point is that in doing the transportation research, we've been seeing an accelerating change. Concepts like automation or autonomous vehicles have been around, but they've never been able to be instantiated because the technology is coming about. I'm not here to tell you that that's going to happen in these grandiose vision that you hear painted by the media, but I'm here to tell you that some form of it may happen. And why will that form happen? Because of the ethos, the things, the millennials, even people who want to age in place are increasingly seeing mobility as a service. So that, combined with Carol's two big words, big data, and then the ubiquity of communication technology. So I work for a company that services all the above, not in terms of the services, but the underlying technology or the plumbing, the communication technologies. I support our automotive products division very much in this goal for autonomy or automated vehicles that have communications. So what do they need? They need high-definition maps. They need bigger, better pipes. So all these pipes are coming about in terms of standardization. You hear the term 5G, that serves big data, that serves these applications. 5G, you have a 4G phone right now, so 5G is obviously the next big thing. One of the things that's driving our standards around the world is what we call mission critical. Transportation is a mission critical 5G application. That means that the key performance indicators are more and more ubiquity, more and more densification, more and more reliable data, so all of a sudden you can use communication to save lives. So we're making Carol's life tougher by having the IT challenge to be even harder. We're providing edge communication capabilities and hyper-local information that happens almost instantaneously. It's a great opportunity. You start to sense cars with basically tenths of a second of delay. And then you can start having demand-responsive services. This stuff seems futuristic, but in reality, it isn't if you look at the pace of change. Look at the other side of the coin in terms of what is necessary. The invention that's happening around here is pretty relentless. The people that are keeping Carol from hiring are doing these things. But I'm saying that in the end, it's going to be a very virtual cycle because the services and the capabilities they'll provide will allow agencies to have choice, either to let the telecoms do it, that may be good or bad, I'm not going to comment on that, but it could be good in that it relieves the workforce and the exciting jobs to, unfortunately, contracted services, which may be the future. But what I'm trying to tell you is, in the end, the types of jobs that will be in transportation are not necessarily public sector jobs. They're not necessarily invention jobs, not that invention is done, but there will be the result of the trends that we see. And the big data and servicing the data in near real time will mean that IT, maybe with exclamation mark, will be the types of jobs that our millennials need to fulfill. And the good news is that they'll be fulfilling those jobs to help those of us who may be aging in place, or even if we don't, that really need transportation on demand to the very last mile, the very last tenth of a mile. So that's my opening statement.
No, that's fascinating. Mark.
So let me tell you a story. Can you hear me okay with this? No. So on Wednesday at 12:30 in the afternoon, I left my house in Bakersfield. Now, I lived in the Bay Area here. I was with Karen and Rod at San Jose State for 18 years. So to me, the Central Valley was Route 5. It was the fastest way to get to Los Angeles. Other than that, you know, I didn't know anything about it. So now I live in Bakersfield, at Cal State Bakersfield. I left at 12:30 in the afternoon, and my Google Maps said it was going to take me 3 hours and 56 minutes to get to Oakland, where I had to be for a Thursday morning meeting. So it's a little under 4 hours. I said to my wife, okay, I'll call you around 5, see how things are going. 4 hours into the trip, I was south of the 152, and I had another hour and 50 minutes to go. 5 hours into the trip, I had another hour and a half to go. The closer I got, it must be some kind of a Greek myth about this. The closer I got to San Francisco, the further it seemed to be. And it took me 2 hours, to give you an idea, to get from Moffett Field to the Oregon Expressway, which is about 2 miles. So if you think high-speed rail doesn't have a really important meaning to me and to the people in the Central Valley, this story maybe makes it really clear. You might say, well, why did you drive? There must be some other options. I could fly from Bakersfield to Oakland through Phoenix, Arizona. That was one option I had. Another option would be to drive to Los Angeles, which is 2 hours from my house, get there an hour or so in advance of the flight, and fly to San Francisco, and then have to get from San Francisco to Oakland. All of that was going to be about $800, my travel agency said, for the airfare. In other words, there are parts of this state that are economically disadvantaged because they cannot get from one place to another. This seems so strange in this high-tech world we talk about. Just simply, you cannot get from there to here. If I had to get to Sacramento, say I was a business person and wanted to meet with legislators, I'd have pretty much the same problem living in Bakersfield or in the Antelope Valley in Palmdale or other parts of the state. So for us, economic development, high-speed rail transportation is very, very critical. And I got involved in high-speed rail education because we needed to educate the workforce in the Central Valley. And it was through the Workforce Investment Board that we first got started. And understand that in the Central Valley, the four counties there, Tulare County, Kings County, Fresno, and Kern County, are among the 10 highest unemployment in California and among the highest unemployment in the country. So Tulare, for example, has 12.4% unemployment. So that's what, about 1 in every 8 people is unemployed. And so when we talk about high-speed rail in that area, we're talking about jobs. And we're talking about people wanting work of two different kinds. One is working on the high-speed rail and being trained for that, which we got involved in, but also a high-speed rail as a place, as a way for people to get to work or for people to come into the area with businesses that are going to support the economy. So we had a program that was for 104 union workers. And since the point that was made earlier, it was truly a collaborative effort. We, as the university, was approached by the Workforce Investment Board, who had $1.5 million from the state of California to educate union workers. These would be journeymen and apprentices. And we had a program for them that took course over a whole year. The interesting thing is the program wasn't just a technology program. We didn't have to teach them how to be carpenters. These were carpenters. These were plumbers. These were pipe fitters. These were laborers. There were two women in the program who were teamsters who drove heavy trucks. There were people in this program who basically were laborers. They dug ditches. And there's a part of that whole economy that's made up of those people, and they want jobs, and they see the high-speed rail as a way to get themselves employed. This program, it was called Upgrade Training, was to get them ready. Now, we did teach them a lot about high-speed rail. I attended a lot of these classes. Rod Iredon, our friend, was a keynote speaker at the opening. We had some of the best experts in the world, actually, teaching basically 100 laborers and union members. So it was a very unusual audience, not an audience you'd think of these kinds of people. From the California High-Speed Rail Authority, we had leadership giving lectures to these folks. But we also taught them the things we talked about a minute ago. We also taught them soft skills. And these are not guys and gals who know much about soft skills. This is a pretty hardcore bunch. We taught them communication skills. We taught them how to some things about working in multicultural groups, conflict resolution. Because we feel that when the high-speed rail is being developed in our area, we want workers who are trained how to work, not just they'll know the their techniques. Because part of building high-speed rail, as an example, when you're building the roadbeds and you're putting in, it's not that much different from what I understand to building a highway. And so they have a lot of those skills. But what they need to know how to do is to get the jobs, get in there, be stable employees, work together, and be able to compete for these jobs. The fear in the valley is that if we don't train the workers and give them some competencies, that they'll be bringing in workers from Texas and from other parts of the country that will take the local people's jobs away. And in the five sessions we had with each of these different groups, the question of jobs and when they would be available came up every single time. This was a very, very serious concern for these workers. So that's one piece, I think, of developing and training people for this kind of work, for high-speed rail. In addition, we're looking at the heavy maintenance facility being located either in Fresno County or in Kern County, and this is likely to provide somewhere around steady jobs, about 1,500 jobs. And those folks also need training. That's a very big number for our area. And the build-out over 4 to 5 years, the California High-Speed Rail Authority estimates 1,300 new jobs. And these would be for the construction workers and so forth. So those are temporary, 4 to 5 years. But then ongoing, when we locate the heavy maintenance facility, that's going to be jobs for the long term. In addition, what I learned in through this program is we're going to see infrastructure build-out around high-speed rail. We're likely to see housing developed, likely to see in places like Fresno, which is redeveloping its downtown to some degree to fit the high-speed rail. We're going to see economic development of other sorts and other opportunities for these kinds of workers. Now, I just want to mention one other thing, and that is universities were not generally mentioned, not often mentioned when we're talking about training people, training workers and so forth. Community colleges come up all the time. But let me say something. We have Dr. Wei Li at the university, who is a world-renowned expert in high-speed rail. He's a Chinese background and actually works out of Tsinghua University and one of the transportation universities in China. There are entire universities that are focused on transportation, and Dr. Li gave some of the lectures to these students. So this is the kind of level we're talking about. Construction workers listening to Dr. Wei Li, who's a world expert in this field. In China, you can get a doctoral degree studying the what's called a bogey, the undercarriage of the high-speed rail train, which I was kind of surprised about that. There are many people getting doctoral degrees. And I just came back from China about 3 weeks ago, and I had the chance to ride the high-speed rail. It's the most common thing to say, well, we're not going to fly from Chengdu to Chongqing. We're going to just take the high-speed rail. And it's a two-hour trip, and, it's just like any here in the Central Valley, this is such a controversial thought that we would have a high-speed rail train in California. And in the Central Valley, if you drive the 99, you'll see a sign, a giant billboard that says, and I wrote it down, here comes high-speed rail, there goes the farm. Okay, that's an attitude we have versus other places that have just adopted this technology. So Dr. Wei Li offers a course in high-speed rail technology in our engineering program. And you might say, well, why do students take this course? Because it's not part of the general curriculum. CSR Sifeng, which is the manufacturer of high-speed rail trains in China, gives students a $500 scholarship if they complete the course with a passing grade. And so the class is filled. So in talking about incentives, how do you get people to get involved in this? That is one way to do it. And we worked, that's a second kind of, so training. So you have training for the workers, and you also have training for people like engineering students who are looking to go into a field. That same class of students, we had another program which was for professional engineers, people already in civil, electronic, and electrical, and construction engineering, came to a special program, a one-week program that we worked on with Mineta, actually, and also a foundation in Spain. And we had a one-week program, and they had 15 slots available for these students. These students gave up their spring holiday to come and actually sit in on that course for an entire week. So we're also training people then at another level, the engineers, to go forward and work on this. And finally, we've been given by CSR Sifeng a high-speed rail simulator where we'll actually be able to teach people how to run the high-speed rail trains. Now, right now, I would say this is not in high demand. We don't have a high-speed rail train. So it's not like there are a lot of people we need to train how to run one. But we have this on campus now, and it's the actual simulation of an actual full-size cab, and you can program it to do different things, teach people how to run the high-speed rail in the rain, what happens if a deer goes on the tracks or whatever. You can do this. So Sifang is coming to set this up on our campus, and we're waiting for the high-speed rail to be built so we can start having classes. This will be the only one of its kind in the United States. So they would have to go to Spain or some other place to learn how to do this otherwise. So looking forward then, there are these many, many dimensions to training people for jobs for these something like high-speed rail. And I think it's a great opportunity. And I do believe the universities, and I'm pretty sure Tom will agree, have a role to play here that's a little bit different than the role of some of the other educators in our field. Thank you.
No, I do. And thanks for bringing that up. I'm actually going to start with you, Mark, and then ask Jim to chime in on this first question. I love the idea of the financial incentive, but I'm wondering how we get, what's the career pathway that gets a student to that point to take advantage of a very unique and specialized program like that? I mean, how far back do we go, or is it just making the opportunity available once the student enters the university and expresses an interest in engineering?
Well, that's part of it. I was, you know, Dr. Wei Li, if you saw him, and I don't know if he's not in the audience, so I won't be insulted. You would think he was a janitor at the university. He's a very humble man wearing baggy jeans and walking around. So having his level of expertise, that incredible knowledge that he brings, inspires the students and he's able to transfer some of the knowledge he has. And he has contacts in China in particular. He uses a textbook that's published in China, and we have no equivalent textbook here. So just to talk about the basics of having somebody with the expertise to educate our people, I think is a critical beginning. I don't know how you get. If I asked Dr. Li, I said, "How did you come here?" He said, "Well, my daughter was going to school in the area, so I started at Cal State Bakersfield, and I just stayed here." It's just one of those fortuitous things. But you know how you'd attract somebody like that. So I think that's a big issue. You know, where do you get the expertise at the beginning stage to then educate the next level? We're fortunate; we have that right now.
Jim, do you have any thoughts on this area?
Certainly not on high-speed rail, although I'm a fan. But to generalize it, certainly. One does not have to have a background in transportation to work on transportation, particularly with these transformations I'm talking about. All transportation is an extension of the types of jobs that would be available as society progresses in its technological prowess. So at an engineering level, you could be electrical engineer, you could be a computer scientist, you could be a programmer. The key thing is that even at every level, it has to have some computer or IT literacy. I would say that would be a thread that has to come going forward.
That's a good point. Kristen, question for you. The economy in coastal California is relatively healthy. Does this make the challenge of recruiting personnel in the transportation sector greater? And if there's an economic downturn, will the task of filling these positions become easier? So I guess the question is, who are you competing with for the positions in the Central Valley from the port sector side, port and transport sector?
I guess if I think about the Port of Hueneme, I think some of the challenges that we have in finding people are going to be unique compared to other parts of the state. One of the challenges that we have is property values are really high, so the cost of housing is really high, so getting people to stay in the county for the jobs that are there, they're not synced. They're not synced in. So that's a really big issue for us, and that's something that we're working together with our Economic Development Collaborative to address. So saying that, I think some of the other challenges that we have, though, that are a lot of the types of jobs that we have are somewhat specialized. Give an example, dredging. That's very, very specialized work, very specialized construction work. The engineering for that is very, very specialized. And there are just not a lot of people in the county that necessarily have that expertise. And it probably in LA and Long Beach might be a little different because they're a much bigger complex. And so there might be much more competition for the positions. But I think in our situation, it's a lack of human capital that's there for us as opposed to, we need more people there that have the skill sets that would be good for maritime work.
That actually touches upon one of the questions that came in on the nature of specified training or training to become specialists versus training on specific equipment or for specific skill sets. And Carol, maybe is training a solution to developing a workforce that allows you to do more things in-house? You mentioned the challenge of having to sort of outsource and use consultants. Mm-hmm. Is there a training solution, or is it just more efficient to do it the way you do it now?
No, I think training on the job is absolutely, it's a must. And it's certainly something that we do. We not only train folks on the job in-house, we have funding to send people to training to strengthen, their basics, management skills, project management skills, budgeting. We're not likely to retrain someone who's very techie to someone who's going to do very soft skill type work. But I think even more important than all of that is that some of the industry associations with which we're affiliated, like the International Bridge, Tunnel, and Turnpike Association, I'm sure you've all heard of it. but it's an industry organization that supports the tolling industry, and they have, for example, for folks who are just coming into the tolling industry, and it seems almost everyone comes into tolling from something else, they have a leadership academy. And so it's a week-long academy in Washington, D.C., with other tolling professionals. So it does a few things. It immediately creates a professional network for folks, and it provides skills training and also just a lot of background information about the tolling industry. So I would say that's a kind of boot camp that is, kind of can jumpstart a person's tolling career. So that's a good example. And I know some folks in the IBTTA organization are pressing to start that kind of organization earlier, to do something at the high school or at the college level to say, look, you could have a career in tolling. What would that look like? And oh, by the way, it's not just bridges. It's not just tunnels. It's also express lanes. And on the express lanes, where we use pricing policy to modulate demand of the roadway, we need skills that you might have as an economist or a behavioral scientist. So just because you're not an engineer and you're not the person who's going to build the civil infrastructure, there's still the folks who have to build the IT systems to sense the demand on the roadway and to impact the algorithms that tell us how to handle pricing so that the pricing can change in real time and send drivers a message about whether they can come into the lane and at what price. So I think those professional organizations have a big role to play as well.
No, that's a good point. And looking at the possibilities for people with skills in economics and analysis makes them transportation workers as well. So, yeah, it's a good point. Jim, is a question for you about, I think it's tied to the question of redundancy and resiliency of networks. What happens when systems go down, and is that a workforce challenge? Do you train people to handle the challenges of complex systems?
Yeah, so you do train people. I'm thinking you would engineer this in advance, so it's a multi-level training. So this is a large scale, what's called a SCADA system or industrial system that is vulnerable to failure. So you design it properly, and failure could mean hacking, terrorism, or just the fact that it's a complex, large system. So you start at the very basic level, but then certainly we all know that, I hate to use this analogy, but maybe I do like it, is that it's like a nuclear power plant operator who's trained in all sorts of failure modes and how to react to it. And as our systems in transportation become more and more complex, this is not just done at the agency level, it will become done more and more as we become more networked at the higher and higher levels. So certainly there's opportunity for training in each of those levels, and it makes our jobs, even or the future generations' jobs, even more complex.
Because so many of the systems are maybe unique to a particular industry or segment, are those easily transferable
Absolutely.
Skills?
Absolutely. There are some fundamentals on how you do failure modes and effects and design a system to be failure-proof that transcend a specific industry. To give you an example, in the automotive industry. There's a system engineering process that stems from the IETF, which is the Internet Engineering Task Force. So, I mean, it's already spanned the spectrum just with that example of 2 points. What hasn't happened is this hasn't been institutionalized so well yet in transportation, but I'm telling you, it's coming. People are aware of it. The whole idea of this threat environment we're living in is hand in glove with the idea that we still have to deliver on time and reliably, regardless of what happens. So, yeah, things are happening. Going back to the hypothesis that IT and understanding networks and every component therein is pretty important.
Great. Mark, question for you. This goes back to the high-speed rail training in education. What connections, if any, are there to the K through 12 cohort? And if not, are there new opportunities that we should be thinking about?
There's another program. I was not directly involved, only sort of the tail end of it. It has to do with the two workforce boards in our area. And they set out a training program that I really found, I was at the graduation, found really enjoyable. These are folks who would never show up in the university. That's not where they were going. They probably did not like school. But what they did was they had a program that rotated them through a series of apprenticeship experiences. So they would spend some time with electrical, some time with plumbing, sometimes with construction, carpentry. And I didn't know this, but I came to learn that wasn't the direction I came through. I didn't realize that there are people who say, I like plumbing. No, I don't like carpentry. I thought, you know, you're a tradesman. But it turns out that there are really preferences. So what they did there was they brought students who were some of them, I think, had already dropped out, basically. They may have finished high school, but they weren't going anywhere, and they were unemployed, and brought them into this program. And, again, they weeded them out. Not all of them. They had to pass math tests and so forth. But eventually, they found a nice group of people that were going to then go into the various trades and go into an apprenticeship program. So I like that for a lot of reasons, and I want to talk just for a minute about this. The collaborative model. And that is, we could not have done, I didn't even think to do a program on high-speed rail, but it was the Workforce Board came to me, and that was the state of California supported that. And then so you had the university, and you had a public sector organization, and then you had the unions that were involved. And often people, even today, were saying unions in conflict and all of that. Actually, Chuck Riojas, who is with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, was key in sitting down with us and saying, what should we put in this program? What do we want the your folks to learn? And there were 14 unions, actually, that were around. They weren't always there, but Chuck was a representative that were involved. And I think the program then really spoke to the needs of those people to get them the kind of training that was going to be worthwhile for them. And I would say the same thing where the unions could speak to the school district and to these students to say, this is what you're going to need, and you're going to get a job when you're finished with this.
That's great. This next question, I'll start with Kristen, but I think a couple of you may have some thoughts on this. Transportation is so broad and so vast, right, that for many people who might have an interest, they think, in some area, but how do you help them find a place to start? If it's the port sector, right, how do you, you've mentioned a couple of programs that you're doing within your own, within your community. What else might we be doing to help identify the career path for them?
Well, just one thought on the K through 12 question, something that we do, and we do quite robustly, is have port tours with kids, and we make a field trip, and they come out to the port for about 2 hours, and we have a very interactive session with the kids, and then we take them out on the docks, and we let them see the vessels, we take them through the processing plants, and then they get to see all the green bananas that come in, and they take them back to their classroom, and we turn it into a science project, and they try and ripen them. But there's really cool stuff that you can do, I think, with our youth, just to create an exposure and start seeding ideas that there are opportunities in maritime. And then, again, as they get older, you make that more sophisticated. Something that we find that our class has been so successful that we want to bring it to the classroom now. And so we're actually working with some folks to build a curriculum that we can take to the schools when they're learning a certain subject that maybe you can integrate the maritime component into the curriculum at those younger levels to start exposing kids to something they might never otherwise thought about.
And I'd like to add something to that too. We're also in a port community. We're a university that serves that community. And we've designed a three-part program called Working and Living in a Port City, which explains to people who live in the shadow of North America's largest port complex how it fits into the broader supply chain, what actually happens on the port, and then the third night is about career pathways once they have a little bit of knowledge. The other thing that we found is the shaping of the mindset of somebody who might choose a career is very much shaped by the opinions of their parents. So we make sure that parents get the opportunity to come to this program as well, free of charge. We have sponsorships that cover it, because then it becomes a discussion, we hope, at the home about, yeah, maybe transportation is not just truck driving. That's fine. There are great opportunities if you have a CDL license. But there are other things that you might want to be thinking about. And the other thing is we look to get the message out to other key places in the community, partner with community events that are taking place at churches and other things where the messages get out to young people and where those opportunities can be discussed. So I just wanted to add that. But from anybody else on the panel, your perspective about this question of how you reach those people and help them identify it as a career pathway early.
One thing about that, maybe the marketing is an issue here. I mean, when you say transportation, I kind of get a little glassy-eyed, frankly. You say, oh, it's a career in transportation. It's like a career in, I don't know, lecturing or something. It's just very abstract. A friend of mine's son works for Harley-Davidson, and I think if you said you're in the transportation industry, he would say, what? You know, he's an engineer, and he designs cool motorcycles, and he's a high-end engineer. I mean, you know, he does all the sophisticated stuff, but he doesn't think – so, I mean, I think it's – you know, what's the exciting piece of this – that somebody's actually going to work on. And again, you know, the people who drive the trucks, they're excited in our program to teach them, hey, well, I'm going to quote one person said at the very end of the program, and I love this, he said, because we asked him, he said, I know I'm not going to be just building a high-speed rail train, I'm building the future of California. That's what he said. And I thought, that is really cool. And that's, you know, so what's the vision here? And it may not be transportation, it may be, you know, serving people. It may be, you know, creating economic value for your community, whatever it is that touches people. I think there's something about the marketing of this that's an issue.
I think it's a great point. Carol?
Well, if I could just add, I should make a little plug for the Intelligent Transportation Society of America. And Jim and I serve on the California version of that group on the ITS California board. And one of the perennial challenges of intelligent transportation systems projects is that you can't touch and feel and see them in the same way as the Bay Bridge or the port. So although I would advocate that it's very important to have data collection systems, for example, in place, those projects are very tough to get funded because there's not a big ribbon cutting associated with them and there's not a lot to go and see. So for the folks that come to my agency, they tend to come to transportation from a place of wanting to foster urban mobility. They're excited about things like Lyft and Uber and apps that can provide you real-time transit information. I mean, I would say you have to come to transportation from whatever angle it is that excites you, because like Dr. Novak, I have a friend as well that works in automotive engineering, and that's something entirely different. Mm-hmm. Something that we do at our agency to try to capture that IT interest in transportation is we hold hackathons. And we just recently had a weekend hackathon and gave prizes for people to come up with apps over the weekend that were, you know, sort of taking the existing real-time transit information and trip planning applications a couple steps further. So I think that's a way to harness that energy.
Yeah, and may I add, I was a judge for the hackathon.
Excellent.
And then I can recall that. So this brings a software development community who don't really think transportation is number one, but they understand that you would provide a location-based service that could have huge value, and they were excited. And, you know, heck, I work in transportation. I work for a semiconductor company. So we transportation touches our lives, and soon enough it'll touch our work lives.
Can I say one more thing? Tom?
Sure. Yeah, please, Kristen.
Just in the kind of the breadth of it all, one way what we've done to try and excite folks at all level about a working waterfront is we have a banana festival every year, and we did it. We launched it in to celebrate our 75th year, our year about 4 years ago. And we thought, well, if 2,000 people come out, this will be successful. Well, 10,000 people came out that day to celebrate the waterfront. It was a huge event, and we have a port pavilion, and it's an opportunity for folks to learn about all the different aspects of the supply chain. And as part of that, we work with a group called Future Ports, and we have a game, and it's the Future Ports game. And you roll dice, and you win fake money, and we give prizes away for it all, but it walks you along the whole supply chain as you roll these dice so you can learn, oh, this one touches a teacher in this way, and this touches a family in this way. And so you kind of just learn throughout the whole supply chain through the port how freight moves, good movements work, and the jobs that are created along the way. So it was sort of a fun educational tool to a very, very big audience. So those are just some ways to bring exposure to the transportation industry and different aspects of it and career tracks.
I'll add, this game is called Ports to People. We've used it as well in different training exercises. We just did a Freight Academy for Caltrans, and it works equally as well with transportation engineers and planners who have to think about the policy implications of what they're doing and some of the unintended consequences that might be in the job sector. So that active engagement and bringing it to life is vital to getting the message across. I'm glad you brought that up. Jim, a question for you. We talk a lot about sort of reskilling, and particularly for people who may have had lost jobs because of economic restructuring. I'm wondering, when we talk about advanced transportation technology, what are the opportunities for reskilling, or is there an inherent tension with the idea that advanced transportation actually makes some work skills obsolete?
Well, it's a tough question, and it doesn't have an easy answer. Tough questions don't, right? So the reskilling, back to my thesis, or one of my theses, the one I'm bringing forward today, is that you could be doing transportation and you don't know it. So the point is that if you want to reskill into transportation in the high-tech area, you have to get reskilled in high-tech. Mm-hmm. That being said, there are very honorable and very good transportation skill sets that are very explicitly transportation-oriented. Mm-hmm. They require at the core intense work at the trade level and all the way through, for example, your planner, Carol, which required a high level of education from the same alma mater that I went to have. But the point is that you can either make it explicit and make it a cause, say that you want to have a civic engagement that is around mobility, urban mobility, or whatever, or you can just reskill and understand that what you have may eventually become transportation, because one of the things I'm trying to say is that transportation as an industry, when you call it other things, is becoming really cool.
No, I think, yeah, that's a good answer to a very difficult question. Carol, yeah, please.
One of the things that we're grappling with in my agency is that we sometimes will get career interest from folks who have been very successful in other industries, in consulting or in high tech in some way, and they don't need to work, but they're interested in applying their skill set to our problems. And that is such a laudable, wonderful thing. I will say that it can be a challenge on so many fronts to bring those workers in. For example, we don't have a lot of flexibility in our pay scales. So while someone may not need to make a wage, we need to pay them something. And figuring out how to bring in kind of a high flyer on maybe a part-time basis or just some other non-traditional arrangement is really tough for us. And I think that's hard for our board members to understand. You know, everybody's got a brother-in-law that works at a high-tech company that thinks they can fix mobility with an app tomorrow. And so when I say something like, well, yeah, we have this really interesting candidate, but I HR's telling me that I can't hire him part-time. You know, it's a very tough fit to find innovative work arrangements that might work for some very creative workers and meld that to our government-defined way of working.
And there's actually a question here that I think is related to that, and it asks about, what are we doing to train the HR personnel to be ready to recognize talent that may not necessarily be transport specific but could be applied definitely to the needs of the agency or the port or the university. So I'll open that one up. I think it's a great question.
Well, I don't know what we're doing, but I hope it's a lot. It's very hard. I find that HR will review a candidate pool and weed people out that we need to weed back in. Mm. It's frankly a skill to try to identify folks who might have the skills that we could mold into a successful employee. I'm sure Kristen has comments on this as well.
It is a challenge, you know, for the Port Authority. You know, we don't have we're not Coca-Cola. You know, you can't hire at those wage levels, but you are expected in many ways to perform at that level. And so there's a big disconnect there in terms of what talent you can secure to support those very high-tech needs, and it's in all sectors. It's in accounting, it's marketing. I mean, we're trying to keep up with all the social medias and the tweeting and the Twittering, and it's changing every day. And you to get talent, you know, yeah, they're going to go to Google. You're right. So there's this. It's a big challenge, and I'm not sure what the answer is. We actually go to the universities and find the kids to help us with social media. I have a lot of interns that are helping us tweet, and they're doing a pretty good job, you know, probably not as robust as Coca-Cola, but at least we're doing it. But it's a big challenge.
Anyone else want to address that question?
Mark? I said about the universities trying to get the kind of expertise like a Dr. Wei Li, you know, to just try and send out a request and hope you're going to get that kind of person show up. You know, a full professor at the university, Cal State, probably makes about maybe $90,000 a year. And that's, you know, you can, an engineer coming out of a master's degree, even sometimes an undergraduate degree in Silicon Valley here, will make $120,000 a year. So full professor means this is quite an established individual who's got the expertise you'd want to have to teach the next generation. Not easy to find those folks.
Mark and perhaps Jim, and I think, Mark, this question perhaps is in response to some of the comments you had made about the potential opportunities for labor and management to work together. And the question regards the IT challenge within the workplace when you have a unionization of IT workers. Can it reinforce the protection of labor roles, and how do we advance and use modern tools when labor and technology are potentially in conflict? That's a tough question as well. So.
I'm not sure. Because I wasn't working in the technology area, I'm not sure I have that much to say about that, frankly.
Okay.
Well, I can give you an example of where labor and technology might be in conflict that's very real here in the Bay Area, which is in the tolling sector, a trend is to go to what's called all-electronic tolling, which removes toll takers from toll booths. The Golden Gate Bridge went that way in 2013. And so when you drive through the Golden Gate Bridge toll plaza, there's no longer a human being there to take your cash toll. The net effect, one of the effects, is that we needed to increase staff on the back end who are sending toll violation notices and opening fast track accounts and opening payments in the back office. So we have a very real challenge here to ask ourselves, you know, do we want to expand that approach to the other 7 state-owned bridges? And this is such a complicated, I mean, it certainly has labor implications, but there are also congestion and mobility questions. There are questions about what this might mean to our bondholders. There's just an incredible array of questions, I mean, the issues related to, well, if we have an express lane network implemented, what happens when you've paid to get into an express lane and now you get to a bridge toll plaza, and are you losing some time advantage that you might otherwise have if all of the lanes are tolled in a different way? Very complex questions, but certainly the issue of what would happen to the livelihoods of the more than 200 manual toll collectors in the region is also front and center in that debate.
Mm-hmm. So let me come back to that again for a second. My experience with the unions on this was they realized that for high-speed rail, as an example, the technology is very sophisticated and the workers are going to need to be upscaled, upgraded, and there is money available. As I say, there were 325 workers that were scheduled to be upgraded, and the unions were supporting that kind of thing. They know that if they don't get their workers up to speed, they won't have the jobs anymore. So I think you can find that coalition or recognition on the part of unions. They want their people to work, and if they don't know how to do the job, frankly, they will come in from Oklahoma and Texas and other places.
Did you want anything, Jim?
Well, not really, but I'll add something. Because I can't talk about the labor technology conflict as technology becomes a bigger and bigger part of the equation. But just to give an example, not necessarily that our policies will follow the same as Singapore's. Singapore just awarded a tender for ERP2, which is electronic road pricing, which is completely contactless. You don't talk to a human, and you have ubiquity of charging. So that certainly takes the human out of the loop at the front end, but keeps the human in the loop at the back end. So I'm not going to say that that is our future. That's mm-hmm. a Singapore present. But the trend that Carol talked about is going to continue. And so these conflicts or these resolutions or maybe these incentives are absolutely necessary.
It's interesting you mentioned Singapore because there's a question here about the Hong Kong smart card being a model and being sort of a generation ahead of ours. And so without talking about specific applications, are there places that from a workforce development perspective are models that you look to? There may be other places in the state, in the U.S. or outside of the region where you view them as being places that are worth emulating.
Is that directed to me?
Any one of you. But we can start with you, Carl, since the question came up about smart cards.
Well, I'm a little unclear how to... first of all, yes, we look to our peer agencies, both nationally and internationally, to inspire the direction of our programs. So, however, I would say, as someone who's also spent time working overseas, there are some serious limitations to applying some of those international examples, and Singapore is a great case of they've done some amazing things, both technologically and from a business perspective with that program that I think, frankly, would be very hard to replicate here. So we definitely do pay attention to those examples. I guess, and I can tell you that, like, for example, we have a very tight network nationally of folks who are delivering smart card-based transit payment programs. So when something happens in Washington, D.C. or New York, whether it's, oh, that procurement document hit the street, or, oh, we had a protest, or our vendor performed in this, that, or the other way, we all know it, and we're sharing that, which is hugely important, and frankly, it keeps the job really interesting as well. In the smart card transit payment arena, I would say there are no great models. Those programs are they have their own challenges in every single environment. I would say I do look to Europe in a lot of ways for models around transit coordination at a policy level, not necessarily always requiring a technology to support coordination. And also, as we were talking about a little bit over lunch, I think some of the educational models, the apprenticeship models that mm-hmm. are available in Europe that are not available to us here in the same way are really interesting and set the standard.
Great. Next question, I don't know if any of you will have an answer to, but I may be able to help the person asking it, so I'll ask it. Are any one of you aware of any training programs utilizing potential candidates in the prison system? Workforce training. So while you're thinking, I will add one of our parallel centers in the FHWA network of workforce centers is one based at the University of Vermont. And actually state law there, if I understand correctly, actually requires reskilling and training as part of statewide programs. So the university and community colleges are actually active partners in developing, designing, and implementing training programs. So it's the only one that I know that I'm aware of. So it might be whoever asked it might be worth checking out Vermont. Yeah.
I wouldn't comment on the prisoners, but one thing that we do at the port is make sure we reach out to the vets and look at opportunities there. And we've hired a lot of vets at the Port of Wanimi that have been very great, and you know they've been stellar employees for the port.
Great. I think we're wrapping up. I have a couple more questions. So if you have any last burning questions, please make sure to get them to me. This, in some ways, relates to sort of perhaps the best practice question, but it looks at sort of the a culture for training. The question asks, what kind of region is best for a career start in transportation? Is it a major region with a well-established network, or are there opportunities for smaller counterpart regions with greater transportation needs? Any thoughts about that?
I would suggest that there are needs everywhere for transportation. In every community, transportation is the backbone of the economy. It's not the sexiest one, but it's the one that's going to get you to work. It's the one that's going to get you to the grocery store. It's the restaurant. It's your transportation network really does feed you, and there's going to be opportunities in every community. They'll be different. If you're in a coastal community, there could be a port opportunity. If you're in an inland in Chicago, it could be a rail opportunity. I mean, it depends on the context of where you live. But large, any size, I would suggest that there is definitely an opportunity in the transportation sector to give back to your community in that way. Yes.
I would say start in California. It seems, you know, the devil you know, you can always see, like, the warts, but certainly I think the feedback that I get from my peers nationally is, oh man, you guys on the West Coast are always doing such innovative things. So if you can start on the West Coast, maybe you're at the cutting edge of innovation and you can find yourself to be more marketable elsewhere.
You know, Mark. Having moved from one of those dense populations to a smaller area, it's really interesting to reflect on this. One day I can recall being at the corner of Market and Embarcadero looking at the ferry building, and in one glance probably saw, and I could probably even report them, 10 different modes of transportation. Public, people on bicycles, skateboards, rollerblading, there's a ferry, there's on and on, taxis, Ubers, Lyfts. And when you go down to a small, I mean, Bakersfield is not a small town. It's 350,000 people. Basically, you've got buses, few taxis, not even, I couldn't even find it really easy to get to the airport one day. I was trying to find one of those shuttles, you know, we have here so commonly. So there really are different scales here of opportunity. But, you know, I do find that people in a place like the Central Valley would like to stay there in many cases. And the question will be, how do we make opportunities for those people to stay in their region if they'd like? And California is not one place, now I'm learning. It's different places.
No, I think that's a great point. I'm going to take my prerogative as moderator and ask the last question. Because, and I think this will help our partners at Bonetta as well, what would you like to see us doing better or differently with you as partners? We're in the business of workforce development and training and education. And we want to be an active partner. So what message should we be taking back?
Are we going down the line?
Sure.
So I think it's sort of what I started with. I would suggest that how do we really have a dynamic dialogue between industry and the academics? So there's an real understanding. I know there's some federal programs that look at this in STEM locally. We have a program called Linked Learning, where we actually have kids get trained for jobs and then they shadow in those jobs and they're guaranteed a job for 2 years. Those types of programs, I think, are needed to really help build career pathways into industry. And I think there's roles on both sides for industry to inform the educators and for the educators to come to us and say, what's going on? Let's help build the future and get our kids jobs, would be my suggestion.
Point. Carol?
I would absolutely agree. I think there's a gap there between industry and academia that we could fill. And I'm specifically actually reflecting on the fact that I personally would have loved to have some kind of mentorship program. There are, again, kind of industry organizations like Women's Transportation Seminar that do provide some of those opportunities, but you know, those are the kinds of things that require some energy to start and to keep going. And I think almost really at all levels, you could imagine pairing up folks, even in very different industries. Like if Kristen were to be my mentor, I could learn all kinds of things from her, even though I'm not necessarily a ports person. Mm-hmm. And I think similarly, that would be an interesting thing to do across public sector and private sector to facilitate communication about, for example, the way that we procure things and how that is perceived, what the public sector challenges are and what the private sector challenges are. So some kind of mentorship network that I think had ongoing sustained support could do some real good.
Great. Jim? Well, I'm honored to be considered a partner, so I'll be the honorary partner. And I think that I'm a case in point, is that this cross-fertilization, this odd pairing, is pretty important because it opens up more vistas. And so if you can continue to think along that a little bit, not linearly, and involve different types of industries or different types of people in trying to develop training curricula or training strategies, it might be very fruitful.
That's a good point. Mark, you have a unique perspective on
this. Yeah, I think there's the piece of the, you know, we're often looking down towards the grade schools or towards the high schools or community colleges. Looking out in the other direction, I'm thinking of a program Mineta has run for years, which is with Caltrans. It's the master's degree for adults. I mean, you asked the question earlier, are skills going to become obsolete? I think the real question is, are people going to become obsolete? And I think that's what we have to really protect against, and we do that through ongoing, continuing, extended education. So the nimbleness of one piece of the university, which is growing all throughout the country, is to be able to offer certificates, advanced certificates, graduate degrees. We're even talking about badges for people who can come to an industry and say, you know, I have a degree in economics, but I've got this special program I took in high-speed rail, let's say, or in port management through you. And say, wow, that's really more important than your economics degree, perhaps, because you've got some really niche skills. So working together with industry and the university, we're the section of the university that can really do things fast and make things happen.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because universities are not known as being the most nimble of institutions. And it's the industry-facing, community-facing part of the university that can. And from my own experience, one of the most, I think, one of the ways that our success is defined most readily is when we actively engage the partners on their terms and on their turf. I think there's an expectation often that people will come to us, we're the academy. But in fact, if we're engaged with industry on a regular basis through organizations, whether it's ITS America or Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals, whatever it might be, I think we gain some credibility and respect as a partner. And we're viewed differently. And then it's a much more strategic partnership as opposed to a tactical partnership. So I'll close with that. Please help me thank these wonderful panelists. That Kristen Dekus, the CEO and director of the Port of Wainimi, Carol Kuster, the director of electronic payments for the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, Jim Meisner, a director of technical standards for Qualcomm Technologies, and Dr. Mark Novak, dean of the Extended University Division at Cal State University, Bakersfield. And again, I'm Thomas O'Brien, the director of the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center based at California State University, Long Beach. And now I'm pleased to introduce you and bring back to the podium Rod Dearden, Senior Emeritus Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute, to close today's conference. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to say a bunch of thank yous and then close out the day. We'll go back to the beginning and thank Dan Richard, the chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority, for being here for the morning keynote. I think he was very provocative and added knowledge to us all, and I also appreciated his celebratory tone about his system under contract, and it's going to happen now. The morning panel, Skills to Build and Operate Sustainable Transportation System, with Ed Reskin, the director of the Transportation Authority of San Francisco, SFMTA, Afshin Peshawar, AP, I'll use that because I always mess up his name, Chief Legal Officer, Hyperloop Technologies, Oliver Baines, the president of the Fresno City Council, and Tim Rainey, the executive director of the California Workforce Development Board. And you've just heard, I'll thank Carolyn Flowers, of course. She was our tremendous noon keynoter, and this is one of her first keynotes after being formally appointed to the Federal Transit Administration acting position, and I think she did wonderfully. And we told her so at noon, and she's off and speaking additionally until she goes back tomorrow. You just heard Thomas thank the afternoon panel. I'm not going to go through those names again. You've just heard them. But Tom, thank you very much for your moderator's duty, too, and for co-sponsoring the program today, and to Karen Philbrick and the Mineta Transportation Institute for your leadership and for moderating the morning sessions. And and then most importantly, to the Commonwealth Club of California for being wonderful landlords and making all the arrangements to make us comfortable and sustain us mentally as well as in our tummies. And we appreciated that very much, George, and your and to your staff. And I think that does it. Have I forgotten anything? All right, then let's all drive carefully on the way home. Better yet, take transit. This meeting is adjourned.